All right, so we're gonna get right into this. No intro. This is just gonna be a quick response to the election, and I am joined on the phone by Jason Pargin, who writes on the site as David Wong, who wrote an article about Trump country that was one of the few places that I saw trying to make sense of this movement that actually did make sense to me. And now this happened. Now they went and elected him. I just got a text from one of my friends who lives in Tampa, and he was like, man, everywhere I look, it's a fucking funeral. Who elected this guy? And so I think that's maybe a good place to start.
I don't actually know where to start, because it's clear this morning that most people still don't really get it. The top post on Reddit for most of the day was a thing wanting to draft John Stewart to be the candidate in 2020, because that was the problem, that the candidate was not liberal enough or entertaining enough or sarcastic toward conservatives enough. And it's like, yeah, you're not getting where these people are coming from. But that attitude of who voted for this guy, it's like, that's actually the issue. The fact that they were invisible through several administrations, Republican and Democrat both. The Clinton years do not get off the hook for this. A lot of welfare reform happened during those years, a lot of banking deregulation, a lot of the things that kind of laid the groundwork for everything we're seeing today. The financial collapse of 2007, the permanent sort of underclass of the working poor that we have now that we're not sure what to do with. No one party gets off scot-free, and that's why they did not find Hillary Clinton convincing. They did not find the argument of it's 8 more years of Obama convincing, even though us in our little left-wing bubble, that sounds great. And this is why they didn't find any of the real Republican candidates in the primaries convincing. This was a uniquely Trump thing because he is not a politician. And the only thing I think that could have countered him is another non-politician who actually was bringing some sort of message of, I'm going to also bring radical change, but my vision looks different from his. But the one thing it's now clear that the voters did not want to hear was, you know what, I've been in politics for 30 years, I'm well respected, here's all these other politicians vouching for me, I'm very stable, and I'm going to keep things going. It's like, that is the opposite of what they wanted to hear. This was a machine that was working against them, and they wanted to break the machine. And that, for whatever reason, here in the UK, with their last national elections, not even talking about the Brexit vote, which happened after that, the polls have underestimated that level of working class, usually white working class, angst and anger. And in this case, it underestimated it drastically in some of the states. Like, people have to understand, this was a wave of voters that showed up on election day. He was trailing in the polls by 4 or 5 points. Some of the states he won, he was trailing by double digits going into Wisconsin, Virginia. These are some of the states he barely bothered to campaign in. Michigan, so this was an overwhelming outpouring of sentiment from that segment of the population I mentioned in that article. And we can go back and give people the title or whatever if they didn't hear a previous podcast referencing
how half
it.
Of America lost its fucking mind. You know, I happen to think that she was very qualified for the job and would have done a fantastic job. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, I think, kind of trying to make sense of a couple things, how this came as such a surprise to a lot of the mainstream media, how a lot of people voted for him when he stands for a lot of things that seem clearly wrong to people. But the article, it just kind of tapped into kind of what these people are feeling, and these people being mostly rural, working class, white people. But, you know, you kind of pointed out how there was a urban-rural divide. It's not a blue state, red state thing. It is a urban rural thing. And sure enough, last night during the election, all you heard was this is the most divided that we've ever seen, urban places and rural places.
You can go look at the county by county map, not the state by state map from last night. The county by county map that shows red versus blue, and you will see an ocean of red. Like, it makes it look like Trump won 80-20 rather than narrowly eking out a victory. Like, because it's, you'll go to like Michigan and you've got a little speck that's Detroit that's blue, and it's all the rest is red. And Wisconsin, same thing. You've got vast stretches that's red and a little speck of blue that's Milwaukee.
The other thing I kept hearing last night is like, where did these people come from? And it's not that like they didn't show up on the census. The people who voted for him voted in greater number than the people who Hillary Clinton and the pollsters were counting on voting for Hillary Clinton. You know, they looked at past elections and were like, okay, this percentage of people are likely to vote. And they made their judgment based on past elections. What we saw yesterday, and I think in the Brexit vote as well, and in the last UK elections, was just a drastically more motivated votership in these rural communities that are, as you put it in your article, being left behind. And you grew up in Trump country, and like the roof of your high school gym leaks, and you know, there's a lot of boarded up factories, and you know, so they're being left behind economically. And I think that people have heard that before, sort of, but I don't think that people have a sense of just how condescending and just how ignored that region of the country is from a cultural perspective. And we spent a lot of a past episode of this podcast talking about that, but you don't see really any respect for the values that those people share. And it's a big part of the population. Some things that they value are like NASCAR and WWE wrestling and more traditional male-female relationships, as opposed to, you know, some of the more progressive ideals that we hold here in the city. And the only place you see those values represented anywhere in the mainstream culture was Donald Trump. So whether it's because he is calculating and very smart strategically, or, you know, got lucky the way that we've talked about Hitler getting lucky and just tripping his way into the greatest seat of power, he happens to appeal to a lot of these people who have been completely ignored both economically and culturally for many years. And there was just a huge outpouring of energy that was associated with his election. And it's not totally surprising to me in retrospect. And I even, heading into the election, thought that I was paying attention to, and I want to talk about 538, because I think that's how a lot of liberals sort of tracked the election, was rather than engaging with Trump supporters and Trump country and, you know, having conversations and debates with them, we kind of sat there and watched John Oliver and comedians like make fun of them, and then, you know, bit our nails and watched the 538 polls change. And at the end of the day, 538 still had him having a 30% chance of winning heading into election day. And I think a lot of people were like, oh, they're just doing that to pump up the drama and make it seem like he has more of a chance. But from the start, they were saying that there could be a polling miss. There could be a big polling miss, in the same way that there was a polling miss in Brexit. I think the key detail that I missed prior to the election, that I probably would have been way more likely to see this coming, is just that those people existed. I assumed when they said that, well, the numbers are saying this and like our polls say this, that they were just saying there weren't enough people to vote him in, but it was just based on really shaky assumptions about who was going to vote and how many people were going to vote. And he just drove an incredible amount of energy with his campaign.
I never know how to phrase these conversations because we talk as if there's zero Trump supporters in our audience, which is objectively not true. It's you see them on Facebook. Like, I get messages from people. Like, a lot of the feedback about that article we're referencing was from people on the other side saying, thank you for saying this. For me and for us, a lot of us here, this is presenting our point of view. We don't see this as taking a political position. We see it as taking a moral position, that saying you're not going to support the racist candidate shouldn't be seen as plain politics. That should be seen as you're standing up for the oppressed. That's like an objectively good thing that everybody wants to believe they do. So if I'm trying to phrase what I'm about to say so that I'm trying to cater to both groups, there's almost no way to do it right, because I don't want to sit here and act like what Donald Trump was doing, was saying, and, you know, and the racial animosity that he was stoking, that that's like just another viewpoint to consider and we should all treat them equally. I'm never going to do that. But at the same time, and if I did do that, or if I in any way try to like humanize Trump supporters, then the vast majority of our audience, especially here the day after, sees that as like a personal betrayal. Like, if I got on, to use a very dramatic example, like if I got on the day after 9/11 and started talking about, well, some of these terrorists aren't so bad, like that's like the wrong time to say that, because they do feel the same way, like America felt the day after, like they watched their country die or whatever. So we already are feeding the same bubble that let Trump sneak up on America is happening right now, because I'm scared of, like, I know that the people listening to this are in a bubble in which Trump is the devil, and we all reassure each other that we're enlightened and we're not as racist and ignorant and angry as the people who voted him in, or, you know, we're all better informed. But I'm just feeding the problem, because this is part of what we found out. You know, this was an election where all of the comedians, the late night talk show hosts, the nightly pundits everywhere except on, you know, on Fox News or whatever, everybody came out in one direction openly, you know, anti-Trump. Everybody, you know, it was universal, you know, on Saturday Night Live. Like, nobody even made a show of trying to be, like, impartial or weighing the two of them. It's, this is the one race where we can just all agree this guy is somewhere between a clown and dangerous and probably a little bit of both. And so you could completely just, every night, you could just get your daily dose of we're right, they're wrong, to the point that you program yourself to think that it's just unthinkable that anyone could support Trump. And so that plays a part into how you see the polls. Like, wow, it only shows Hillary's up by 5. What's going to happen is on election night, everybody's going to come to their senses, because from within the bubble, it's carefully programmed that you only see the worst of the worst Trump supporters. If you've got one guy who wears a racist t-shirt, or a t-shirt that makes veiled death threats, that will get spammed across our left-wing bubble here, and we will look at that and we will congratulate ourselves for not being that guy, and we will think that's the entire Trump movement. The entire Trump movement is the kids on Reddit, like, posting the Pepe memes. It's the psychopaths on Breitbart with their crazy headlines, just clearly trying to say, like, the most outrageous thing they can say. And we think, that's not the America I live in. Half the country is not these freaking alt-right Pepe meme spewing crazy people. Therefore, Trump can't win. And that's the thing. You're right. Half the country isn't that. But most of Trump's support isn't that. And I know, because I've spoken to them, because they're my family and they're people who live back home, and I, due to circumstance, I run into them. I also live in a red state. Like, you can't avoid it. And for every one truly crazy person shouting, you know, racist slogans, you've got a lot of people that are just, this system is so completely calcified to and frozen in place to screw over the little guy, the only option is to blow it up. And only one candidate is offering to blow it up. So no, I don't think on the Democrat side, like if you ran Bernie Sanders, okay, here's a guy who's another guy who's a lifelong politician. Like he sounds great inside your bubble, but you have to understand how Bernie Sanders would play in rural Milwaukee or rural Wisconsin, rather. Everything he represents still everything that they don't like. A guy who's, you know, speaks the language of government and of political correctness and all that. So it did take a Trump to do this. It could have been somebody else. And in some ways, I think you may, if you're against him, you may wind up being fortunate that he has something of a boob. But they had a lot of reasons for supporting him. And if you just tell yourself, now they're racist, they're all just mindless racists and white nationalists, you're still going to stay in your bubble. You're still going to be blind. It's going to keep sneaking up on you because you're not understanding where their anger came from. And the truth is, even if it is a snarling person at a rally screaming racist slogans, that person's got a story. They got to that place in their life somehow. People don't pop out of the womb with a swastika on their neck. You know, they make a series of choices to get there. And we know from history, and we know that there are factors in society that create these movements. And you can do things to combat them, but you have to acknowledge that it's a real thing. You can't just be dismissive of it and just be very snarky and sarcastic and just endlessly make fun of these people as being ignorant or hateful or whatever, whatever, because we now have evidence. That's not a winning technique.
We're not saying it's not fair. We're saying it doesn't work. Just to, you know, talk about the other side of things, I know that people who aren't white guys are probably somewhat annoyed to hear the perspective of white guys being like, all right, here's how we make sense of this. Let's not panic. Let's not, you know, lose our minds here. And, you know, we've heard from them, and we're going to have some of them write articles for us on the front page of our site expressing just the absolute grief that some people are feeling. A teacher I know teaches in a primarily Hispanic neighborhood, and her kids are, she's just having an open class today where they talk about the election. And, you know, kids are worried that their parents won't be there when they get home. And I've spoken with Black people who are annoyed that we're surprised that this happened, you know, that the nation was willing to elect this person. So at the same time, it does seem like if we just chose to stay sullen and despair in the immediate aftermath, we would only be furthering that sort of bubble and that division between the groups. Whereas I think it's valid to immediately try and start digesting this and breaking it down and trying to make some sense of it.
Well, it's the only thing I know how to do. Full disclosure, I'm a well-to-do white guy. I'm going to be fine under a President Trump. If anything, like my taxes might go down. So I'm on here trying to help people make sense of it because this is the only tool I have to, like everyone who's upset about this result, the next phase after you're done being upset is to say, okay, what do I have available to me to help this? You know, are there groups I can contribute to? Or, you know, Planned Parenthood, do I need to contribute to Planned? Do they need my help? Do they need money? Is there something I can do? Can I volunteer? This right here, this is it. This is my, I have a platform where I can talk to people. So I'm not trying to dismiss anyone else's fear. Their fear is legitimate, not just of Trump, but of the movement that produced him. But for me, the only, when I'm scared of something, the only thing that makes me feel better is digging up as much information about it as I can. You know, if I get a diagnosis of a weird disease from my doctor, you can bet I'm going to be on Google that next day, like trying to find the history of it, you know, the survival rate. Like, I want to know everything there is to know. So right away, and in the article that we just put up today, a couple of hours ago, under the succinct title, Don't Panic, I ran through some numbers. First of all, from the election last night, let's put this in perspective. The final vote was 26% of the population about voted for Trump. 26% voted for Clinton. It looks like she will win a popular vote margin by a very narrow amount. And then 2% voted for, about 1.82, something like that, voted for the third party guy, Gary Johnson. And then 47% stayed home. So the overwhelming winner was, I'm not messing with this. So this change was made by a quarter of the population. Polling wise, as a country, we're still more progressive than we've ever been in the history. Like, it's not even close. And I ran through some numbers, and again, to the articles on the front page of the site is just called Don't Panic. But like, gay marriage, which had no support 30 years ago, or probably even 20 years ago, today it's 55% in favor to 37% against. So it wins by 18 points. Some form of legal abortion is favored by 56% of the population. 41% think there should be some restrictions. Background checks for guns are overwhelmingly popular. Universal health care. Asking people, do you agree that everyone should have some sort of guaranteed health care? 58%. Only 37% opposed. Global warming. We used to be terrible as a country that was skeptical of global warming. Not true anymore. 64% say they're either a little worried or highly worried about global warming. Only 36% say, no, I don't believe in it, or it's not something to worry about. So this is a country that, it's the same country, and we're a more progressive country than we were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, even 10 years ago. And many issues, the changes happened very, very rapidly, like gay marriage. Some of what we saw last night was a reaction to those changes, but the country did not flip and become conservative overnight. Like, at least three of those Trump states also voted to legalize marijuana last night.
That kept putting the thought in my head that there's literally no person I would want to less smoke weed with, when I just kept seeing those next to each other. Being high with Donald Trump would be the most terrifying thing I could imagine. But sorry, I didn't want to interrupt.
Well, no,
I did have that thought. It's repeatedly.
It's just to make the point that you had people going into the voting booth. One, Trump won a lot of Obama voters from 2008. He flipped like four states last time I looked. And which means a lot of the exact same human beings, like people voted for Obama in 2008, voted for Trump this time. If that seems utterly incomprehensible to you, good. This is what we're trying to, we're all going to get smarter together here, all right? Because it shouldn't be. There are a lot of people who do just vote candidate by candidate. That they're not locked into a party. And they gave Obama a chance because after 8 years of George W. Bush and the wars and terrorism, that certain segment of the population is like, you know what, this isn't working, let's give the other side a chance. And they voted Obama. They were not super ultra liberal. They were not feminist. They were not out there on Tumblr yelling at people for using the wrong pronouns or whatever. They were people who just, they're somewhat in the middle, and it's like, let's give the other side a try. They gave him 8 years. And a lot of these problems that we inside the left-wing bubble like to ignore because you kind of want to stay positive about your guy, which is that, you know, the economic recovery completely skipped the rural parts of the country. We have this poor working class segment that's now like 70 million people, people who are working and they're in poverty. That's permanently entrenched. They have no easy way to get out of it. They're locked in. They're unhappy. You've got suicide rates climbing, addiction rates climbing in these segments of the country. So yeah, after 8 years of Obama, and even like with the universal healthcare stuff, like Obamacare, you are getting, you know, rising premiums. You're getting people don't qualify. They fall in between where they're not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid, but they don't qualify for other assistance or whatever. Like, it has left some people out. It has not everybody benefited from that. So after 8 years, they're saying, all right, now we're going to give the other guy a try. And again, Trump was the only other guy. There was no other option. If they don't want 4 more years or 8 more years of Obama, Trump was the only answer. So to go to them and start yelling at them about, well, what about when he said this racist thing, or he made this crude joke, or he did this? It's like he was the only other option.
Even if you still hold a high opinion of Obama, it's totally understandable and to be expected that, or at least we're see this is part of a global process that seems to be happening where jobs are fleeing rural areas in the Western world for the cities and for other poorer countries. And, you know, that's part of this process of globalization, and it's part of the stage of globalization that America and England seem to be at. And whether you think he did a good job or not, those are the circumstances he was working under.
I feel like this conversation, like this would probably have gone over better. Like we wanted to get this up the day after because, you know, people come to the site wanting to talk to somebody about it or wanting to hear somebody talk to them about it. That's fine. Right now, I get that there's a knee-jerk revulsion you have when you try to think too hard about a group that you can't stand, or that you think is repulsive. You resist the urge. It's like, I don't want to know more about these people. It's like somehow knowing more about them legitimizes them. It's like I'm giving implicit permission that this is an okay way to live because I'm talking to them and treating them as human beings. And just by doing that, already I'm giving them too much credit. And I personally believe this is a fatal flaw in the way liberals and progressives think. It maybe it's true of everybody, but the absolute refusal to even engage these people as anything other than hateful garbage that must be endlessly mocked, and we figure like we can shame them into coming around. And humans do not work that way, because now with the internet, you can go seek out like-minded people. And if someone tries to make you feel ashamed of anything, whether it's racism or whether it's some sex fetish, whatever is socially unacceptable, today I can go find somewhere where 10,000 like-minded people are hanging out and feel this relief of other people saying, you know what? You're not crazy. You know, I also am aroused by clowns, or I also am mad about immigration and wish I could bring up my concerns about immigration without just being shouted down as a racist and cut off. Like I wish I could tell people I'm terrified of crime without just being called a racist, and then just, you know, I'm banned from the discussion. I wish. And so these people find each other, and this is how what we call hate groups form, but it's the one place where they can voice these concerns that I, the guy talking right now, happen to think are monstrous and destructive and immoral. But my reaction to thinking that those beliefs are monstrous and destructive and immoral should not be to say, therefore, I'm not even going to dignify this with a discussion, because that's not how society advanced to the point where we're at. That's not how we put slavery behind us. That's not how we put segregation behind us. Once upon a time, politicians ran on segregation as a position, and debates were held. Once upon a time, you know, abolitionists had to hold debates, and one person is arguing that black people are not human beings, and they're having to, you know, a black abolitionist having to listen to them, stay calm, and say back to them, no, here's some evidence for why I am a human being and should not be subjugated and treated like an animal, and had to debate it as a point that was worthy of debate. Because we feel like we've advanced, part of the advancement is like, we're beyond that debate now. And we're very bad about that. And if you ever want to see evidence of it, if you ever are out and about on the internet and you see some guy say something's kind of racist and you confront them on it and say, hey, that's kind of racist. If that person comes back and says, yes, I am a racist. I believe that some races are inferior due to genetics and due to cultures that make them just less adapted to the modern world. And I believe that the only rational response is to shun those racists and those races and lock them out of the system. You will find it's actually really hard to argue against that person, not because they're right, but because you've literally never done it. You've never like sat down and went through the research that demonstrates why black poverty happens, you know, why immigration can help a country. Like, you don't have the numbers at hand. You've never had to sit down and walk somebody through it and try to educate somebody. Well, once upon a time, they did. The country had to be debated out of segregation. They weren't just shamed out of it. It was a slow process of kind of convincing people one person at a time, but by engaging them. And on the internet, you can live your whole life without ever engaging somebody outside of your bubble. Except the way we do it is we're completely shielded from their point of view until like one of them says something incredibly outrageous or ugly, and then we let that in to get that little dopamine rush of outrage, like that very pleasurable sense of righteous outrage, like, look at this monster, let's all laugh at this monster, let's all remind ourselves how great we are because we're not wearing a t-shirt that mentions, you know, lynching people. We're not the guy who kicked over the wheelchair at the Trump rally. We're not that guy. And that's our only exposure to that side, is the worst of the worst, the most outrageous, the most flamboyant. And I have sat here and watched since the 90s an entire industry spring up of talk radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Ann Coulter. Their entire business model is they know that liberals cannot resist passing around outrageous quotes, especially ones that skirt around the ideas of race or things like that. So whenever they release a new book, all they need to do is just say 3 or 4 outrageous racist things and then let us do the work, because they're providing a service to us. They're giving us something to get outraged about. We get that quick little high. For them, it drives up like Google search traffic and visibility. They sell books and everybody's happy. And once I started seeing what they were doing, like seeing what Milo does at Breitbart, and like that whole model of just trying to be as outrageous as possible and trying to like antagonize you, like that's all they're doing is they know that in order to pierce our bubble, they have to be as awful as possible. And that gives this false impression that everybody on that side is this hyper-aggressive monster. And it's just not true.
If you doubt that Ann Coulter is a mascot for horrifying conservative beliefs, like specifically designed to outrage liberals, she had this tweet that went viral that was, if only people who had 4 grandparents born inside the United States voted, Trump would win in a landslide. That is specifically an echo of an actual Jim Crow law. Now, that was not an accident. She specifically knew what she was doing. She knew that tweet was going to go viral specifically with the people that it went viral with. That's her job in the culture. And as long as we keep the interaction between these two bubbles, and I would say that Trump supporters are a bubble themselves that is just as guilty of ignoring the liberal bubble as the liberal bubble is of ignoring them. But as long as we keep it at that Ann Coulter dopamine rush level, we're failing. And that's not something I've realized until this morning, that looking back, I never took the time to define the words racism or sexism, or like explain how specifically those words that people think are innocent are actually harmful, or, yeah, like you said, I mean, we have actually made those arguments on the podcast, but that's not generally the way that I engaged with this election. The way I engaged with this election was, like I said, watching the percentages on 538 and sitting back and watching it like a sports spectator. And then, yeah, mocking and hating and being disbelieving of Trump supporters from a distance and arguing with people in a way that is not just outrage porn, but actually trying to convince them and doing research to convince them is exhausting. It's hard work and it can seem futile, but you and Mac, John Cheese, are both people who started out as Republicans and are now, were eventually treated not by just being shouted at, but like people kind of spoke with you and engaged with you and you were willing to do the research yourself eventually. And that is the only way that change happens.
And I can tell you, you said that there's probably an equivalent bubble on the right wing. I can tell you what it looks like. I mean, I listen to right wing talk radio because it used to play in my workplace like all afternoon. There was like six straight hours of it at the job I had in high school. And what they do is they just carefully curate the dumbest liberal quotes and actions and policies and only present you those. And there's a lot. Like San Francisco was a bastion of this sort of thing. Anytime there would be some school in San Francisco that started teaching sex ed in second grade, Rush Limbaugh was there. Anytime there was some government program in some liberal city, like instead of killing the rats in the sewer, they wanted to humanely catch them and transport them to the country at great expense, Rush was there. Like, and the narrative was the death of common sense. That was the phrase you heard a lot. There was a book by that title, that the world has gone mad. And so everything about, you know, and I can see it now when I hear it from my family, when they talk, they hear the stuff about trans rights and bathroom usage. To them, it's more of that. Like, it's just, these leftists are all hippies. They're totally disconnected from the real world. They have no concept of how things really work. They sit there at their Occupy Wall Street protest from a few years ago with their iPads, their iPad that was made, mined with, you know, rare earth minerals from Africa, powered by coal that was mined by coal miners in Pennsylvania and burned and belched smoke into the sky. And they will use their iPad, you know, built with sweatshop labor in China, and will use it to type out like, hey, come join the revolution. You know, we've got Wi-Fi here at Occupy, at our Occupy camp. They had no problem finding very ridiculous examples of liberals who seemed to, by and large, like to it feel like they were better than you, but without thinking too hard about why. They like to take positions that were very popular in the pop culture and that seemed like they, you know, the complaint, for instance, and I was, you know, still a fan of this around when 9/11 happened. The complaint was that there's plenty of liberals that are just anti-war, period. Like, war is bad, but could not understand the concept that sometimes you intervene in a country because it's on the verge of a much bigger war. Like, sometimes you go there to prop up a regime to keep it from falling into chaos, that you can actually save lives, because they would simply take this flat position of, nope, war is wrong, violence is wrong, period, without really trying to understand that a lot of the ugly things we do, you do because you're trying to prevent a much uglier thing, that we prop up dictators because there's a much worse dictator waiting in the wings. And that you can see it play out in the Middle East now, that you kick over one very bad guy and the country and the power vacuum is a bloodbath. And you realize, oh, it actually would have been better if we had helped that guy stay in power, even though he was a jerk. So from within that right-wing bubble, it simply looked like liberals were people who emotionally liked to pat themselves on the back but did not like to do the hard work of understanding how the real world actually worked. So, I think a lot of the people listening to this, if you sat down at a table with Ann Coulter, and she's someone who does this for a living, she's got a million racist facts she can pull out of her head because that's how she puts food on the table. You would lose a debate with her about racism because when she started talking, you would get so angry, you would start shaking, but you would never put together an articulated point. You would just start screaming, Nazi, Nazi, racist, Nazi, instead of where she's pulling out facts and figures saying, well, actually, if you remove the black population from America, America's crime rate is lower than Switzerland's. And I just made that up. I don't know if that's true, but she says things like that all the time. Now, if you spend a month researching, you can come back at her and say, well, actually, the black crime problem is not due to blacks being genetically inferior. It's due to a century of Jim Crow laws that actually made them a permanent economic underclass. And where you have a permanent economic underclass, you have crime 100% of the time. And mass incarceration has built baked into the, but listening to me explain it, it's so complicated and you would really need to know your stuff. A lot of people don't do that. They don't engage with somebody who has listened to Ann Coulter's lines and these quick little factoids and felt the relief that always comes with, you know what? The awful thing you've always felt ashamed of thinking, it turns out it's true. And that's what people like her appeal to, that you feel uncomfortable around black people, where I'm going to give you some facts and figures that say you're perfectly justified and that, you know, it's their own fault they're committing crimes. If they don't want to be known as criminals, they can stop committing crimes. And she's oversimplifying. No one needs to comment telling me that I am telling you what she says. But you can convince people. I know because I've been there. You can. And we've done it. I mean, look at the numbers I read off. I put at the beginning of that article for a reason about all of the polling stuff or how progressive the country has become. The other people, the previous generation, didn't all just die. They were convinced. And if you are scared of Donald Trump and, or more importantly, are scared of the half the country that supported him, if you want to defeat him, if you want to stop him in his tracks, if you want to make sure this doesn't happen again, that's going to occur only by convincing his voters that your way is right and his way is wrong. And whether those voters are people who are just voting based on economic anxiety, whether it's immigration anxiety, they're worried about globalization, or they're worried about healthcare, or even if they're one of the worst, the people who read Breitbart every day and sit there and get high on the outrage of all the terrible things liberals are doing, they too can be convinced. But they are not shamed out of their positions. That simply doesn't work. And what The Daily Show does and what John Oliver does and what now Samantha Bee does and many other outlets on YouTube or whatever, where they simply, you just mock those people and call them monsters and you roll your eyes and it's like, how could anybody possibly, you know, believe these things or support these things? That doesn't work. That doesn't bring them around. That's not what brought me around. That just back then just drove me further into the arms of the bubble because I went to seek protection. And if I, you know, when I went off to college, I started running into these very liberal professors, as you get in college. Like, all that made me want to do was go back and listen to talk radio because, by God, on that show, there would be something hilarious that a left-wing professor was doing somewhere or had said somewhere. And it would reassure me that the discomfort I felt when this guy was calling me a racist, that he was wrong. What it eventually took was me mainly just moving away and meeting different people, meeting literally the first uncloseted gay people in my life, you know, getting to know some people of other actual human beings of other races and being exposed to different ideas. It took, you know, a few years, but I came around because, you know, human beings, yeah, they're changeable. They really are. I know it doesn't seem like it. It definitely doesn't seem like it today, but they are.
And this might sound all very theoretical, but one place that I've heard people sort of talk about engaging with Trump supporters is with their parents today, or with relatives of one sort or another. One person in a editorial meeting earlier today was talking about, they were talking to their dad, and their dad was like, well, you know, the FBI agent who investigated Hillary Clinton's emails, his house burnt down the next day. And she was like, I think you want to fact check that, Dad. And he actually did fact check it and was like, called her back 5 minutes later and was like, oh, you're right, that was a hoax. But, you know, I spent some time arguing with a relative about Trump this election. But looking back, and I have no idea whether this person voted for him or not, but looking back, I didn't really engage them. I wrote a carefully crafted metaphor about if somebody who was an experienced pilot was able to take over the plane I was flying in, and a mentally ill person who had never flown a plane before also was trying to argue for taking it over. But all I was doing was calling the person that they liked crazy, and then, you know, pointing to experience as the thing that Hillary Clinton had going for her. And those are the exact things that Trump supporters seemed to value in Trump. And rather than doing research on, okay, here are some politicians in other countries who have come in as outsiders and failed to work out as heads of state. I think that's happened, and I think they have had bad results in the past. People kept pointing to Reagan. Reagan was in charge of California for years before he went to the White House. If I had gone and done that research, and then also the thing that this person kept pointing to was how corrupt Hillary was, if I had gone and, you know, investigated them and done the fact checking for my relative, maybe that would have been one less vote.
I mean, all of this, there's this thing where anytime you're having a discussion in the wake of somebody else's tragedy, and as you mentioned, like how differently, like, you know, women and minorities see this as opposed to us, where the sheer fact that we're able to just sit here and calmly discuss it as a rational thing is offensive to some people because we're not being appropriately horrified. And that's, I understand that. All I can say in response to that is, this is the only way I know how to cope. Like, I impose calm and logic on myself, or an air of it, because it's the only way I know to direct that energy. I don't know what else to do, because I'm not going to just get drunk. I don't drink. I'm not going to just check out. I have to be at work, you know. And this is something that, for instance, comes up whenever there's a controversial police shooting. A policeman has shot an unarmed black man, and the video's out there, and, you know, and there's outrage and people taking to the streets and all that. And I always enter these conversations, and I always try to be like, well, you know, actually, like, we don't see how the video began. It's not, I can see how it wouldn't be clear. Like, I'm trying to be very analytical, but I can do that because I'm not at risk of being shot by the police. I'm a middle-aged, upper-middle-class white guy. So the fact that we're sitting here trying to be so calm about it and talking about, well, you need to engage, you need to do this, instead of just screaming and taking to the streets and demanding change, that alone is a privilege. I understand that. I guess my only position is that there's no shortage of despair and outrage and rage on the internet today. There's plenty of that to go around. This thing that I do for myself, where I try to say, all right, let's pretend that we're a Vulcan. Like, we're a robot. Let's just approach it like a robot, same as if it was in the wake of some natural disaster. You know, instead of sending thoughts and prayers, I want to come back and say, no, what do we need to do? Logically, what do they need? What can we contribute? What can we donate? And it's kind of the same thing here. Like, my being outraged or being sick to my stomach, that doesn't benefit anyone listening to this. It doesn't benefit a single minority. Like, my outrage, my personal feelings in my gut don't help anyone. So what I can do to help people, I guess, is try to help them work through it, help them try to think through it rationally, help them feel a little bit better by walking through the same chain of logic, you know, that I did. But I get that this is, everything I'm saying is from a position of being one step removed. I'm not in the line of fire here, and I just want to keep reminding people of that. I'm trying to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, you're legitimately afraid for your families, Jack, like the example you mentioned of the teacher. Like, they're legitimately, this is not an abstract academic thing. This is, they're scared of what will happen to their families within the next year due to, you know, policy changes. This is actually, families could be torn apart, people losing jobs or whatever. I acknowledge all of that. I don't want to skip over that and get too clinical about all of this. I just want to make it clear, this is the only useful way I know to talk about it.
Yeah, I was sick to my stomach to the point of feeling like throwing up last night. But I do think, in addition to understanding where this election of somebody who said such hateful things came from, I want to also reiterate the fact that he targeted a 26% chunk of the population that had been culturally ignored and abused for a long time, and that, as scary as it is, it does seem like, because the numbers that we're looking at are 53% to 51%, and that it gives you the illusion that more of the country is hostile towards people who aren't white males, basically. And I think there's a lot of progress that's been made, and that I've heard this point made a lot of places, but, you know, it does seem to be a pendulum that swings back and forth. And like the commentator said on CNN, this seems to have been a racist, white supremacist whiplash reaction to what was a very progressive act of electing President Obama 2 terms in a row. The racists, that scared something in them. And I don't want to make it seem like that wasn't part of the Trump movement, and he seems to be trying to put some of that stuff behind him. But, you know, you pointed out at one point during the election that every time he would say something that was like a dog whistle or even openly somewhat un-PC and racist, the mainstream media would, you know, freak out and cover it. And you would actually see him go up in the polls, or like see his numbers strengthen. And that is a really terrifying thing. There is a chunk of the population who we haven't gotten to yet. And the only way that I know how to get to them is armed uprising or or talking to them and explaining things carefully and in as much detail as you can for as long as they'll listen. Another thing that I just feel like I'd place that I failed just as a citizen and as the editor-in-chief of a media outlet is that this morning, like, I kept tabs of the Drudge Report because I'm always interested in seeing what that extreme right-wing part of the media is saying. And there was a lot of stuff about Trump's first call being to or from the Egyptian prime minister and his great relationship with, it was one of the leaders in Israel. And I was confused by that, but you were saying that a major part of the storyline that just didn't make it into the sort of liberal mainstream media bubble was that Hillary Clinton was going to start World War III. That was something that a lot of Trump supporters were afraid of and convinced of during the election that I hadn't even heard one mention of in my following of the election.
I've been very hesitant this whole time to say, to ever try to put a spin on it that it's like, well, he's not so bad. You know, he's not so bad. And like, there, we have listeners, again, we have Trump supporting listeners right now who, when you mentioned like being physically ill when he won, like they rolled their eyes so hard that they probably injured themselves. And, you know, in 2008, we have, still have it back there, a message board thread where we went on the Free Republic, the ultra right wing message board, after Obama was announced as the winner. And it was just hundreds and hundreds of threads of, well, now's the time for armed insurrection. Like with Obama, like, well, we have this Muslim Manchurian candidate in charge of the White House. The only there's no more democracy. Like, democracy has failed. Only armed insurrection can fix this. And we were laughing at it because, you know, that's like a very, those ultra right wing boards tend to be very old, very white. And it would be, like, as someone mentioned, like, you would hear their rascal scooters coming from miles away when they try to launch their armed insurrection. They're not obviously equivalent, but this was their insurrection. Like, this was it. They had their revolt at the ballot box, which is the way it's supposed to happen. And what you were saying about people talking about politics as being a pendulum, I think a lot of our younger readers truly don't understand this, because it may not be apparent in the way they teach it in school that the 1960s and the civil rights movement was a direct reaction to the 1950s and the post-war years. The Reagan 80s were a direct reaction to the 1960s free love, you know, equal rights, gay rights stuff. And you can break it down even further by region or whatever, but we always overcorrect in the other direction is the point. Like, we, you know, we always push a little bit too far, and that is an ongoing cycle. And I'm trying to explain this without doing that obnoxious wealthy white guy thing of, oh, it's fine, this is just a process, it's fine. I know it's not fine. Again, I get that it's not fine for many of you. I'm trying to say that even with the racism, even with the potential rolling back of rights or regressive policies, that cycle has been continuing since the beginning of America. One side gets power, they always push things a little too far, a little too fast, and then the other side recoils and then seizes power. And this is how we have prevented another civil war for however many years, 150 straight years, is because we take turns at the wheel. We don't even acknowledge we're doing it. It's just built in that eventually we get so sick of one side. And then, you know, in the Clinton years, even though the economy was good, by the time that those 8 years were up, we were sick of the Clintons. We were sick of the scandals, sick of the sex scandals, the, you know, low-level corruption, all that stuff. We were sick of it, and we were ready for something different. That's why Al Gore lost, in the same way that Hillary lost. Like, they tried to hand off the baton, and the country was like, no. We may be deeply overthinking some aspects of the Trump stuff, especially when you sit down and you parse every single controversial quote and say, you know, so he admitted to sexual assault, therefore 26% of the country is in favor of sexual assault, when there is a much more boring but historically accurate way to frame it, which is that we were due for someone who was the opposite of Obama, no matter what. If it had been someone else running, it would actually have been really inspirational what Trump did, because he went up against a political machine that had like 5 times as much money, 10 times as much staff, 100 times as much mainstream support from other politicians, from celebrities, from the media, universal support across the media, you know, a massive ad campaign, more ground, and he beat it himself with no help. Like, that would actually be an underdog story if he wasn't, you know, such a doofus and or monster, depending on your point of view, because America simply wanted that. Like, it wouldn't, we could have held this election in May and we would have gotten the same. We could have skipped all of this, the debates, the 80 million hours of ads, the campaigning on the ground, the knocking on the doors. We could have skipped it all. We would have gotten the same result, because the country was just ready for something different. And you can say, well, no, deep down, they all hate women. Deep down, they're all okay with sexual assault. Deep down, it's all about race and racism. All of this stuff played a part. But also, historically, looking back, look back through the cycles, look back through the polling, look back who won each election, we were also due to have whatever the opposite of Obama was. And in previous years, we would have said, well, he's a Democrat, so the opposite is a Republican. But because they weren't super hot on the last round of Republicans, that also, they wanted the opposite of Obama. They wanted the opposite of a smooth talker. They wanted the opposite of somebody who was, you know, ultra, you know, politically correct and liberal and had, like, and Trump is the opposite of Obama in every way. And it's true, him being white is part of that, no doubt. And the fact that they wanted a white male after not having a white male in office, yeah, that's part of it. Even people who don't admit that's part of it, subconsciously that's part of it. You could see it in the criticisms of Hillary Clinton, the way they would never say, I hate her because she's a woman, and they probably don't think they hate her because she's a woman, but they hate her voice. They hate how shrill she is. They hate her laugh, how she cackles like a witch. They use witch terms when talking about her. That's all subconscious stuff. Men, a lot of men don't like being ruled by women, or they don't like having female bosses. They would react in a confrontation with a female police officer much different than with a male. They don't tend to respect female power. All of these are sometimes subconscious attitudes that just manifest themselves as, I don't like that. But before you assume the absolute worst about people, before you assume that every single Trump voter hates women, is okay with rape, hates minorities, is okay with racism, the reality is the fundamental forces of the election. If you ignored the candidates and just looked at the, you know, approval ratings of the party in power, the economy, the unemployment rate, all of these things pointed to the other party should have had something of a comeback. And the fact that the opposing party had been in power for 8 straight years, and just the way we do things, even if it had been establishment candidate versus unnamed non-establishment candidate, you probably would have gotten a very, very similar result. So the best face I can put on it, and I realize it's not my job to put a good face on it, but the best face I can put on it is that a lot of people overlooked all of the bad things Trump did and said, in the same way that I overlook the way that Obama has expanded the NSA, the way that he's approved drone strikes, you know, in ways that maybe should not be legal. All of this stuff happens in the background. You kind of overlook it because it's like, well, for the greater good is what matters. And the same way with Bill Clinton, we overlooked all of the sex stuff, all of the possible rape stuff. And it's like, well, you know, we'll never know what really happened. But what matters is that he stood up for this group and that group and so on. They're really saying the same thing. Like, they figure he doesn't mean it when he says the stupidest of the stupid things, that he doesn't mean it when he talks about, you know, dropping nuclear bombs on ISIS or killing their families, that he's a guy who kind of talks off the cuff. He kind of talks out of his ass sometimes, and that we're just going to accept that because the greater cause is what matters, and the greater cause is that this is a system that is killing us. It's killing us. We're dying. Like, in the rural areas, our death rate is going up from lack of healthcare, from, you know, from suicide, from depression, from opioid abuse, and something's got to change. And if this imperfect buffoon is the only one, then I'm going to ignore all this other stuff. And it's not that I'm a racist, but I just don't think he means that. We have a lot of ways to rationalize these things in our minds, and we do it for our own leaders and they do it for theirs. And the best thing I can say is I don't personally believe, based on the polling data I mentioned, our positions, you know, as a country, our opinions on various positions, I don't believe that half the country became bitter, open racist overnight, or, you know, or misogynist overnight. I think a lot of that stuff was undercurrents, and that most, I don't know what percentage, I think most of the people voting for Trump just wanted a change, and they saw him as the only option.
Yeah, the Clinton Lewinsky thing is a thing. Just, I meant to mention this in a past episode, but that at the time I had a different point of view because I was like a teenager, and now as an adult, it's way creepier what Bill Clinton did, because she was just a kid. She was 22 years old. You know, when I was 16 and it was happening, I was, you know, she might as well be the oldest person in the world to me. But final thing I want to hit on, just going with what you were saying about there's a chance that this was somewhat inevitable. The only person who has all along for the past few months, while everybody was, you know, talking about whether Hillary Clinton was 60% likely to win or 98% likely to win. The only person besides people who had a personal vested interest in the Trump campaign who believed that Trump was going to win was this professor, Alan Lichtman, who developed these keys to the White House, which are 13 true-false questions. They're things like, after the midterm elections, the incumbent party holds more seats in the U.S. House of Representatives than it did after the previous midterm elections. You answer that true-false. Contest. There's no serious contest for the incumbent party nomination. True-false. He said, okay, based on this equation, Trump is going to win. He said that 2-3 months ago. And he's stood by that because all the different factors remained the same. And none of those things mention the candidate's beliefs or what he thinks about women or, you know, what his personality is. They're just things about social unrest and economic conditions. And that's really all it comes down to, according to this guy. And he's predicted the last 30 years of elections correctly ahead of the election. And he's also, I think he based his model off of the previous, I think going back to Lincoln, he developed these 13 true-false questions using the winners of all previous elections. So that does lead me to believe that it was somewhat inevitable and a thing that was going to happen one way or the other because of economic conditions and the kind of progress of the political parties.
If I had just one closing thought, it would be there's a viral clip that's going around of, I guess, Stephen Colbert did an election special last night, and this was how he signed off. But he actually, you know, going back to talk radio, like the whole thing with talk radio in the 90s is that invented the idea of making politics something that you follow, not during election years, but something you follow every day for entertainment. And that was a new thing. And what's Colbert was making the point was that now we have a lot of outlets for this. We have a lot of daily TV shows. We have a lot of, he's like, politics was not meant to be followed that way as a sport, where it's like every day you log on to see if your team is winning or if you're, you know, there, one of theirs got caught in a scandal. So now, you know, they've got to catch one of yours in a scandal. And it's, he aired the position that he thought that this was ultimately a destructive thing. He's like, you can be active for your causes and you can help people. You can do whatever you need to do to make the world better. But this thing where we sit down and just follow these feeds or these listen to these shows and it's just outrage after outrage after outrage. And you just get that, you get addicted to it. Like you get that little hit in your brain. Like what's the awful thing that Trump's people have said today, that it's not good for you. And it's probably not good for the country, and it's not good for politics. That's something I want people, everyone listening to this, to really ask yourself is, over the next few years or the next few months or few days or few weeks, how much of the stuff you're consuming and the volume of it you're consuming is actually helpful and making you more informed versus you just sort of getting that quick high off the outrage of getting angry, because getting angry does get you high. It's brain chemistry. And really consider modulating how you follow it, what you follow, your sources that you use to follow it, and just for your own mental health, if nothing else. But because I think that it's very easy to give yourself the excuse that, well, I watch this because I want to be an informed citizen. I want to be, you know, I want to be on top of the issues. Really examine, do your habits result in that? Or do they just make you angrier? Do they make you hate the other side more? Does it give you more disdain for your fellow man? And really, it's something I think everybody should examine, because I think Trump is a product of a few decades now of that talk radio culture and now the Breitbart culture of kind of just poisoning people every day. And as Stephen Colbert said, he's like, it's a case where you sip a little bit of the poison and it kind of tastes good. Like it's, you know, it's like it stimulates you and you get a charge off of it. He's like, but too much of it and it just will make you an awful person. And there's a certain type of awful person where they're awful because they get so entrenched in the idea that the other side are monsters that that's all they want to do is endlessly reinforce that idea. But no matter what cause you're standing up for, if you're using that cause as just an excuse to make yourself really have more and more hatred and disdain for the people who don't believe in that thing, you're not helping that cause. You're not. You're not advancing it. You're not winning people over to your side. Ultimately, I think you may just be harming yourself and the system as a whole. It's something to think about.
Yeah. We will link off to that clip in the description of this episode, as well as the 13 Keys to the White House article that explains how you can predict the different elections even without knowing who the candidates are going to be. Jason, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today on this national day of clusterfuckery, I guess.
For half the country, or celebration for the other half.
Yeah, it's a clusterfuck. Some people are having a big orgy, other people are having a big funeral.
That's not what a... Okay. That's a fitting end to the conversation.
You have not been to my clusterfucks, man.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.